Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is episode number 141. We're in the ending process of wrapping up December, wrapping up 2009. Probably many of you are thinking, boy, I am glad it's over. It has been a rough year. There's others that are saying, wow, this has been a great year. It started out a little rough, but you know, it turned out to be a great year. I hope, you know what, money aside for a second, let's just hope that everybody had a great year overall. Otherwise, that if you had any troubles, any setbacks, that it's time to overcome those and we can get on with moving ahead and rebuilding. We're going to talk about a few things today. We have a pretty good show, I think, lined up. We're going to talk about some of the basic issues because I thought this time of year is a great time to start on the course towards refreshing our basic investment skills. And we're going to talk about the Quanta Funda Tecna. I'm going to bring Kevin Hoffman in here, and he works with us here, and he's the guy that does all the screening and the analysis, comes with the great ideas. And we're going to talk with him about the process, talk about the dogs of the Dow, break down some individual stocks in terms of the fundamentals, and then get into the technicals. And this is actually going to be part of a two-part series because it's going to stretch, I think, that much. And we're going to have that much. We don't want to pack this into a two-hour episode. So we're going to talk about some things today and what's going on in the world and the markets and politics. A few other things that maybe you're interested in from the world of investments. Maybe a couple of ideas for you. And then we're going to switch over and start talking about how you, in fact, can utilize some of the tools that we know are available to you to find some of these great ideas and to really hopefully find that diamond in the rough that will be out there. And maybe not so much the diamond in the rough, but maybe some things that are undervalued that you can get into and make some money on. Because what are we talking about? This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and it's all about disciplined investing, processes, techniques, strategies that can make you, you know, do much better for yourself on the road to prosperity without falling in a pothole along the way. So let's start talking about what's been going on with the dollar. I think it's an important topic to be discussing. And what I find really fascinating about this is that we have seen the gold bugs come out of the woods and talk about gold. We had some clients actually call us and say that they want to put all their money into gold. And we said, boy, why would you want to do that? But, you know, they were just kind of halfway kidding around, a bit of tongue in cheek when the movement of gold was one direction. Well, the last couple of weeks, we've seen the direction turn dramatically and gold lopped off a lot. You know, the precious metals moved down, oil moved down as the dollar was gaining traction. And more so than the dollar gaining traction, it really was on a rampant rise for a number of days and close to 2 weeks because of the strength that we saw in many of the economic indicators and some of the other commentary that came out of the Fed, and particularly in Ben Bernanke, when he talked about that they may start thinking about taking back some of the stimulus, or at least slowing down some of the stimulus. Now, let's explain that, because a lot of people have asked me, and I've had people write into me and said, why is the dollar strengthening this way? It seems almost ridiculous, because in a way, if you think about it for a moment, right now we have the situation that the dollar could theoretically strengthen under any circumstance. Let me explain why. So you have the environment now that things are getting better and there may not be any further stimulus and there may not be any further tax breaks and there may not be any more liquidity pumped into the system. And that in itself says that there's not going to be maybe quantitative easing and a burning down of the dollar moving forward. And let's just take that as theory for a moment. Well, that would obviously, you know, cause people who were short the dollar to think about taking their profits, covering their trades, and moving into, maybe not into the dollar, but at least getting out of their short. So that's the first thing that we saw happen. The second thing that we saw happen along the way, and maybe even concurrent to that, was that Greece, Dubai, Latvia, and a few other places around the world were showing a lot of problems in terms of their sovereign debt. Well, what do you do if that happens? You go to the safest currency out there, and whether you believe this or not, the dollar is considered the safest currency, and people decided to put money in. Well, that caused more of a chain reaction. People were starting to cover up and cover the short positions, and now we had a short squeeze go on. Now, once that started happening, obviously there was a lot of people that got on the bandwagon and wanted to take their profits even more, and it just kind of really started moving, and then you had more economic data came out that wasn't as bad, whether it was the housing number maybe or you know, it was one of the employment numbers that came out. We only saw 11,000 non-farm payrolls last month as opposed to the numbers we've been seeing all the way from 700 down to 3.2, and now all of a sudden a surprise 11,000, quote-unquote, only lost during last month. Now, whether that was an aberration or not, it still was a number that was a data point that caused a lot of people to rethink their strategy. Now, on top of that, we saw that Eastern Europe is giving a lot of trouble to many of the banks throughout Europe. Therefore, the euro was under pressure. So now you just added this and added this and added this. Was it the perfect storm? Was it the perfect setup? Was it something that couldn't happen again? I don't know, but it was a lot of things that came together all at once. Gold came down, materials came down, and silver came down. A lot of the precious metals came down, of course, as well as oil. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing a flattening out of that. The dollar all of a sudden is starting to pick up a little bit of steam from in reverse now. It's starting to kind of slow down, fade. It tried to base out a little bit at about the 142.5 per euro. And that looks like a number that would be very, very difficult for it to break. 140 would be very difficult for the dollar to break right now. And no matter how good the economic numbers are, we think that there will be a level here, somewhere right around here, that the dollar will start to rest at. It's really done an amazing retracement of the up that we saw in the euro, that is, compared to where it is now over the last 4 weeks. So the question then remains, what happens with gold? What happens with precious metals? Is the U.S. out of the woods yet? We're still saying that there's a possibility for a double dip, at least a slowdown in the second half of 2010. And we're going to be on guard. We're not going to be, you know, panicked about it, but we'll see what happens. Kind of ride the wave as long as you can. And if things get a little choppy out there, well, get off the wave and do something different. But right now, we are seeing there's a lot of things that are looking better locally here in the U.S. China's being kind of a little bit temperamental these days, because now they're talking about really taking the money off the table and really talking about reining in on the banking and the amount of the trillions of dollars worth of loans they put out there, because it looks like there is a real estate bubble. Wow. Could you imagine China having a real estate bubble? As a matter of fact, the amount of loans they put out with the government banking and the banks did almost identical to what we did only a few years ago by giving loans out to people that maybe shouldn't have had it, maybe doing a very low loan-to-value ratio. I mean, it's a repeat. But they think they're different because, of course, everybody does. And they can rein it in and they can control it. But I question whether that's really possible or not. A couple other things we want to talk about. And here, I want you to pay attention to this, because this is something, I think this is something that's very important to look at. And I think a lot of people have had a lot of questions about this. I know I've gotten emails about it. I've gotten discussion from my friends and colleagues about this. But I want to try to tie something together. We talked about this briefly on DH Unplugged this week. And there's something happening with the markets in relation to politics, in relation to governance, in relation to world agreement. And I want to throw three things up here. I want to talk about financial regulations. I want to talk about healthcare reform here in the U.S. And I want to talk about the climate change initiative. We'll talk about Copenhagen. We'll just target it and call it Copenhagen. So the financial regs overhaul, this is where we're supposed to make a big difference so that we don't have any more of these banks that are too big to fail, that will break them up, that will make sure that we don't do things like lend out money to people that don't deserve it, and that maybe the loan to value shouldn't be 2%. We're going to make sure that our companies have enough assets and the backing of the tangible asset value and tangible assets inside of the banking so that it's a quality organization, that we will not see a situation where they could take down the entire world like almost happened a year ago. And we don't want to see a repeat of that, okay, of course. And now we look over to the healthcare initiative and we see a from where we started out, I don't know how long ago, but where this bill started out almost, I guess almost a year ago, the concept of a healthcare reform, a healthcare overhaul, because it was getting to a situation where people couldn't afford to pay for it. Now, I don't know about you. I pay for my family $1,500 per month for a family of five, two kids in college and one who's still 14. But $1,500 a month, I don't care how much money you're making or not, that is a tremendous amount of money. Now, I don't have a Cadillac plan by any measure. I have an HMO. I think we have Blue Cross Blue Shield at this point. We kind of bounce around from United to Aetna, depending on where the pricing is, what the plan structure is. But you know what? This is really absurd, and it's only getting worse. And at the same time, you hear from the doctors saying, wait a minute, they're cutting down my payment, but at the same time, I'm paying more for my own policy. I'm getting it from both ends here. And we're seeing this financial overhaul. We're seeing this healthcare overhaul go through the process and get very watered down towards the end. The Brookings Institute has talked about the financial regulatory reforms as being wholly insufficient and not even scratching the surface. Greenspan even talked about some of the problems that he sees, that the potential is for another banking meltdown, as we've seen, and bubbles are forming. We'll reserve to comment whether we believe that, or at least we even respect that opinion these days after what's happened. And many others are talking about how the financial regulatory environment right now is not doing what they should. Let's not even bring up Ponzi schemes and other kinds of deals where we talk about Alan Stanton and Bernie Madoff or Scott Rothstein and all the things that have gone on pretty much right under the nose of the SEC. But more than that, the bankers are back in full motion. Sure, they did a great job of doing PR spin, of giving money away to charities and to help and all that, but at the same time, unparalleled bonuses are being taken in the industry just months after the whole thing almost cracked. And then let's add in Copenhagen for a second. Whether you are on the side of believing that there is a global warming though that is man-made or is natural, whether there's no global warming, whether it's a hoax, the truth of the matter is that there was a meeting for 2 weeks that was all about creating a global alliance to cut down on greenhouse gases, to make a pact that we have greater efficiency, less reliance on pollutants and on carbon-based, any kind of energy source that will be polluting and potentially causing additional global heating, kind of a global warming, a very broad-brushed approach to the discussion. And yet at the same time, they came out of that, again, much different than was intended to go into. They came out of that with non-binding resolutions to hopefully, this is the kind of thing, to hopefully do better. Now, they didn't even, you know, when we look back at the Kyoto Agreement that was done, they didn't even meet those goals. Now we have the next round of this, which is just kind of like, I will if you will, and then we're hoping for the best. Already we see the backs up of China and many of the BRIC nations and the emerging markets saying, this is terribly unfair. We're not going to be doing this. And at the same time, we see the reality showing up in stocks like the coal stocks. I've been talking about Console Energy. We talked about that and also Patriot Coal on DH Unplugged. We own those for our clients, CNX, PCX. And here's the point, though. The point is that the run-up they saw post the Copenhagen announcements post the meeting was unbelievable, and it was almost sad. Sure, this profit to be made, but it's almost sad. Like, what's going on? How come we can't get anybody doing what they say, saying what they do? And no wonder why the congressional approval ratings and the presidential approval ratings are in the garbage. They're horrible. So when we look at now tying this all together, when we look at the financial regulations, we know that, yes, we have credit card bills that are on tap to be launched very shortly, but then we hear stories about a company charging 75% interest on the credit card because they're going to do it up until the time the rules go into force. Sure, I guess that's the right thing to do, and maybe not the right thing, but legal, and it's by the book, but is it something that they should really be participating in? And the financial companies have gone back to their very risky play. Fannie Mae and Freddie are loaning money at the 5% corridor for loan to value. We hear that Fannie needs another $400 billion potentially to get them out of their problems. And we're seeing in the healthcare arena, the stocks of United Health and of WellPoint and many of the other Aetna and the other HMO providers move up higher and higher the closer it gets to being approved. The Senate has done a few things that are more than questionable. The topic of buying votes and essentially, you know, paying off senators, like we saw with Senator Nelson from Nebraska, where he got the ability to his abortion. He didn't want abortion to be paid for in any shape or form with the bill. And somehow that got changed and he's okay with it. And he was very adamant about not voting for the bill. But lo and behold, Nebraska finds that now they're in the situation that they're the only state that is exempt from paying the, I think, 10% surcharge tax for Medicaid to pay for this plan. Now, of all the states, why is it Nebraska is exempt? Could it be that Senator Nelson has had so much power because he was the 60th swing vote to create the majority that they needed to cause the bill to get pushed through? And his vote counted so greatly that they needed that? Was it for the $100 or $200 million to the senator from Louisiana that got extra payment because of a clause that was put in? Or all the other special interest earmarks and payoffs that were made? It's absolutely horrible. But you know what? We don't have to look to see that nothing's really going to be done. We could just look very carefully at the stocks that are out there. All we have to do is look at what's going on with regard to, you know, United Healthcare or Consul. We know that these stocks aren't going to be hurt, it seems. And when we tie this all together, there's a common thread. And that common thread seems to me to be that it is now known by the markets, just the whole nature of the markets and investors, that there is no teeth in any of this. There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance. But there's not a lot of teeth in any of this. I'm sure you've considered this. Now, tell me if am I talking about something that's not happening that nobody's realized before? No, I don't think so. Of course, you can, as a side note, if you want, comment and write to the show notes for the show at thedisciplinedinvestor.com and put your comments in and tell me if I'm off base. I mean, doesn't it seem that, you know, there's a lot of huffing and puffing going on and nobody's blowing down the house? Everybody is safe. And at the end of the day, there's not going to be any problem with regard to, you know, the banking. They're going to go along their merry way. And if they have to, they'll get bailed out again. And nobody's going to really slap any surcharge on the polluting companies out there that are causing excess greenhouse gases. And I'm not saying this. Listen, I am not saying this from a pedestal that, you know, oh, we want this and this and this, this utopianistic attitude of what's going on. But I'm just saying that, you know, it'd be nice to have a little greater understanding and this transparency that this administration talked about so that we can have a little bit of understanding what's happening and what we're really doing. Or is it all just for special interest and back to business as usual, which is why probably I'm pretty disgusted at this point. I was really hoping just for a moment, even though I am, you know, curmudgeonly on some of these issues, political issues in probably primarily when it comes into the politics of the world. You know, we know there's just a lot of rhetoric going on. We know there's leaks going on. We know there's manipulation of the news and items, not in a way that you would think about, you know, from a Russian manipulation of that. No, we just know the leaks that are going on and things that are happening are unchecked and they're being done for a purpose. All right, fine. So we use that as best as we can. The question, though, is as investors, how do we judge and how do we invest best? Well, that's what we're going to get into in a second, because we're going to talk about some ways where the emotions are put aside and we look at investing from a three-step process. And we're going to talk about the quantifunded technique and how we actually manage money. But some of the ways that we can teach you on and some of the tools we can give you. And we're going to spend some time talking about that today and also talking about that for next week. We'll finish it up, giving you some stock ideas as well this week and next week that you can look into. So stick around. We're going to bring on Kevin Hoffman. We'll hook him up in the studio here. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Hopefully you enjoyed that wonderful 5-second musical interlude. It's Andrew Horowitz again, and we're here with Kevin Hoffman. And I've told you, actually, last time Kevin was on, which kind of keep bottled up, he's the brains and the number cruncher, the analyst, and the portfolio manager, all bottled up into one. Last time we had him on, though, boy, we got a lot of emails saying, you got to have that guy on more often. So, Kevin, you have quite a following, buddy.
I know. I can't believe it. One time and only.
Basically, I thought what we'd do is talk about some of... We unlatched the cage and let him out today to bring some holiday cheer in the form of potential profit-making opportunities. And I thought what we'd do is we'd kind of start off with a discussion. Kevin, we talked about talking about the Dogs of the Dow because it's that time of year again. You know, for those of you that don't know, the Dogs of the Dow is a strategy that was made popular a number of years ago, and it's a pure quantitative process, and this is why. Because basically what you do is, and it's a very simple one, by the way, and that's why we're starting with this. You basically take the 30 Dow Jones industrial companies, so that's easy, right? And you find the highest yielding securities in that group. And then what you do is you take the top 10 highest yielding, and you invest in them. After 1 year, you do the same thing again. Any changes are made, and you just hold it for 1 year. Now, historically, the Dogs of the Dow have done very well. As a matter of fact, compared to the Dow, have usually beaten them because oftentimes the dogs, as they're called, are beating down stocks. And if you think about it, usually what happens is that you have companies that are paying higher dividends, not because the yield is higher. So you have a stock that maybe was $10 with a 50-cent dividend, and that was 5%. Well, maybe that stock is cut in half now, but the yield is 10. So what we're looking for is the greatest yield plays here because they're often the most beaten down. Now, one caveat. A number of years ago, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was chock full of and almost 100% dividend-paying stocks. But then a few years ago from here, we saw things like Microsoft and technology companies and other companies enter into the Dow Jones to make it more representative of the markets because it's only 30 stocks, for goodness sakes. And what happened was that now you have, let's say, 25 stocks to choose from. So now the Dogs of the Dow are really the 10 highest dividend-paying of the 25 that pay dividends. The problem with that is, would we ever see a Microsoft, as an example again, in the Dogs of the Dow? Maybe that's going to be a great play for that next year. So I think the last couple of years, the Dogs of the Dow have not worked as well, and that's because the makeup and the constituents inside of the Dow Jones Industrial Average have been changed a bit. But what we thought we'd do is take you through the process of how do you find the Dogs of the Dow, maybe who they are right now, so that we can learn a little bit more about the screening process. So Kevin, what do you got?
So one of the great sites that we use, it's got a really good screener, is FinViz, and that's at www.finviz.com. And on there, if you go to the screener in the upper left-hand side on the blue ribbon, you should be able to click on that. And then under there, you'll have the ability to screen for stocks with several different techniques. You have a descriptive section, you have a fundamental section, and a technical section. And within that, you should be able to narrow down your stocks to whatever you're looking for. In the case of the Dogs of the Dow, you're going to want to look towards the index on the descriptive page and change that to the DJIA. That way you'll only get the stocks from the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
So now let me just interrupt you here. Because the point there is we call that the universe. So we look at what universe are we looking at? We're not talking about this, stellar and stars and galaxy universe. We're talking about the universe of stocks. So right now there's maybe choices of what? There's a Dow Jones Industrial. There's maybe S&P 500. Yeah, maybe you just want to look at NASDAQ, whatever it is. We're just looking at that universe. So that's the first step. We're narrowing down stocks. And the first thing we're doing here is choosing the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which just naturally just gives us 30 stocks. So that's the first step.
Right. Okay. I guess the whole point of the screener is to take that universe of stocks and narrow it down to something that you're looking to purchase. And when it comes to the Dogs of the Dow, it's going to the Dow Jones first.
Okay.
So that's the first step in the process. And the second part is that you want to sort it by dividend yield. And in order to do that, you can just go up into the filters section and sort it by dividend. And then at that point in time, you have your top 10 stocks of the Dogs of the Dow.
So that's pretty easy, and it's very straightforward. And I thought it would be kind of neat if you would try that. Because just go over to FinViz. It's free, which is kind of cool. The other thing that's really important to know about screens that always makes me nervous is garbage in, garbage out. If the information that you put in, or if the data that's provided by the screening source is bad, all bets are off. You could have the greatest screen in the world, but if you're looking for example, maybe dividend yield is easy, but if you're looking for, let's say, a particular stocks that have an ROE of over 25, and maybe you have, you want to look for a specific EBITDA and all these different things that are much more specific, and the information isn't scrubbed in quality, well, you're going to get back information that may not be what you were looking for, and then you're just blindly investing, and that's not very good.
Yeah, and that's always the case with fundamental data, is you never really know if the data is real or not. And
well, that's spooky. But this is I think this is Thomson Reuters.
Right.
They get the flows from Thomson Reuters, which is and this is not a commercial for VinVis. You know, there's a few screeners out there. There's Stock Charts has a screener. MSN used to have the best screener on the market, but in their infinite wisdom, MSN, they pulled the screener, and I don't know if it's ever coming back. That's a problem. But this is a good substitute, and there's also IBD has one, Investor's Business Daily. There's one on Forbes. There's one on Google. I don't like too much. Yahoo has one. And there's a few other places, but to be honest with you, the easiest one to use, one that you can save the screen on, and that's why I like it, is FinViz. The problem we run into is, again, two things. Where's the data come from? And the second thing I think is extremely important is, you know, can I trust this site to be there in the future, and can I save my data so I can run these screens over and over?
Right.
So that's something. So with that in mind, with all those scare tactics in mind, you know, FinViz is a great one. But the other thing is preloaded screens. You can look, for example, I think you could do a pull down inside of FinViz and look at just all sorts of things. Like, for example, give me something and tell me what shows up there.
You've got some things like top gainers, top losers, new highs, downgrades, upgrades, and several different ways to look for technical patterns, such as head and shoulders, multiple bottoms.
That's how I look for the women.
And
oh, sorry. That was bad. Maybe. That was bad. Multiple tops. Yeah, good. Nice. Yeah, no, forget all that. Okay, that was never said.
Right.
We're going to take that out, right, after?
Probably.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's holiday time. Come on. Have some more eggnog. Anyway, so yeah, so there's great technical things to look at. So, for example, you want to find a head and shoulders pattern, and you just click on that. It'll give you the list. You can then, what's really nice about FinViz is that you could look at it in different ways. Again, not a commercial for them, but I think it's something for the holidays to take a look at when you have a little downtime, and then you could use it maybe into the new year. So let's talk about how – now, we don't use – I'll be honest with you. We don't use FinViz here. We use it sometimes to check on a few things. If we, you know, just an easy-to-do screen. We have a Bloomberg system in here and multiple terminals that we use in order to find that. We find the data to be very clean. The problem is, if you want to use it, it's about $2,000 or $2,200 a month. So the differential between, let me check this out. The differential between $2,200 a month and free is a large gap, right?
That's a fairly large gap.
Fairly large gap. So, you know, the second best right now is FinViz. So let's talk about, for example, a stock that we had on one of our screens, okay? We pull up a screen that does a lot of things. Like we have, for example, what are some of the things on our screen, one of our screens? We have many different screens, but for a growth-related security, we start with fundamentals?
Right. Yeah, typically what we're doing is when we first screen, we're screening for the fundamentals. And what we're looking for there is, you know, your EPS growth rate, your EPS growth quarter over quarter, your revenue growth quarter over quarter, your cash flow per share, your return of equity, the various different ratios such as price to equity, price to sales, price to book, and your PEG ratio is probably one of the more important ones that we look at, right, rather than just looking at the PE. There's some problems when you look at just a PE screen rather than looking at over industry wide.
Hey, so let's just get back that up. Let's give some more information. The reason we like PEG is the PEG is the, everybody here's a PE, right? Price to earnings. What's the earnings per share of the stock compared to its price? So you get a number. I don't know, 12, 20, 30, whatever it is. What does that mean? It means nothing. Unless you do a comparison against other stocks maybe in the same industry.
Right.
But then you get into a problem. There's so many conglomerates out there. What industry are they in? You have a company like Dell. What is Dell? Is Dell a retail company? Is it a technology company? I mean, what is it? You know, and then you have like an Amazon. Who knows? Is it a shoe store? Is it a bookstore? Is it an eBay kind of commerce site? I mean, what is it? So when we look at all these different parameters, we have to come up with something that makes a little bit more sense than just doing a comparative and a relational type of comparison when it comes to a stock. So the PEG ratio is a good way to look at the stock by itself. So it's we look at the price earnings ratio, the PE, so that's the PE and PEG, and we look at the longer term growth rate. So let's say the PE is 20, just as a number, raw number, 20. But the growth rate is also 20, so another 20% per year. Well, if we look at that and you think about that, that means that we divide it 20 by 20, it's a 1. So now what happens is when you're looking at the growth rate and you're saying, what's the price earnings ratio? What's the valuation and what's the relationship of the stock price to the earnings and the PE, the forward earnings? So if we see that it's a one or less, we find that to be a stock that may be in a value situation. In other words, something that may be a reasonable value play. If it's 2, 3, 4, it's just out of control. Something's not right. The price is well ahead of itself. Now, again, always, we don't use that on its own, right?
I mean, No.
But it's a tool. It's another right. clue. This is like a game of, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, it's just one more piece to make that edge, one more piece to make the body to find out what's going on. So let's talk about Cognizant. Again, this one that we own for our clients, the symbol is CTSH. So when we first found this some time ago, what do we like about it?
I think the major thing that we're looking for at first is the EPS growth. And a lot of times what we'll look at is, you know, how fast is the company growing and how is it doing on a quarter-over-quarter basis? And when you look at that, you see consistent growth over time in the, you know, anywhere between 15 and 40%, which is very good for a company to grow at that rate, especially in this environment. Also, you want to look at is the revenue growth. And Cognizant has put up decent numbers. Anywhere from 15 to 40% on a quarter-over-quarter basis. Also, what we'll be looking at is the debt of the company. But once again, that's one of those things that we have to consider industry-wide because, you know, there's certain industries that need the debt that it takes a lot more startup money versus other companies like technological companies that require very little startup.
So, but a company like, well, clearly a bank or financial, maybe a real estate deal or something like that needs, obviously, capital. They usually do it through debt.
Right. They'll need a lot more leverage in order to get the company started off. And then once the company's started, then maybe they'll be paying down that debt. But
so what happens to the company, for example, that's a technology company that we generally know that has no, usually doesn't have a lot of debt, let's say that, right?
Right.
But we see a big old 120% debt ratio on our system. What then? What are we to make? Are we supposed to say, okay, well, they're just using debt, or is it something that's like a red flag?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a red flag, but it's just a matter of you got to go into the details then there afterward and find out where is this debt coming from? Is it because they got new equipment, they have new manufacturing processes, and various other things? You know, so if Intel decides that they want to make a new processor and they need this whole new system, then they're going to have to go out and buy the system. And, you know, they may not have the cash on hand in order to do that.
Environment too,
exactly,
to grab the debt. So the question is also what's the length of time till the debt is paid off? Now, where do you find all this? I mean, you know, you're probably sitting there listening to this going, okay, where do I get that? Well, you look at the balance sheet, you look at the cash flow statements for some of this, and you could look at reading the quarterly statements. You could look at and listen to the conference calls and things like that. This is what you have to do. Yeah, you could throw a dart these days, maybe at a stock here and there. You can clearly get something with a big name that, you know, everybody's following. But if you're looking for some of the more, again, the diamonds in the rough and some of the things that maybe are an unknown that are going to be the next real big winner out there, the question is, how do you find them? And oftentimes we find them, they crop up inside of our screens. All of a sudden, what we always look for is, what's new on the screen? You know, what happened? Why did something all of a sudden come on there? Because maybe there was, for example, when we have all these criteria that are blocking, look at it as blocking the bad stocks from getting in, or the stocks that we don't want in, and all of a sudden something comes in, wow, what's the change? Was it that their growth rate all of a sudden spiked up and we could say, wow, this is going to be recognized by investors out there as a great opportunity? You know, is it because all of a sudden we saw their PEG ratio drop and maybe the fact of the matter is that they're undervalued at this point? So, you know, you look at these kind of situations and you see a pattern developing, like Kevin was talking about the growth rates. And you look at the debt rates, you look at, you know, how the investors are, inside investors are trading. Talk about that a little bit. Talk about what's the importance of insider tradings and mutual fund holdings and institutional ownership. How do you explain that, the importance of that, and what to look for?
Well, I think there's several things you need to look for. And that's when you have insider transactions, whether it's officers in the company or whether it's some other employees that are required to disclose their holdings, you need to see why they made the transaction in the first place. Several times it could be just an option exercise or a planned sale, and sometimes it's an unplanned sale, but you really need to figure it out you know, there's plenty of times that you have these various 13C filings.
Well, you have 13Ds, 13Fs, all that.
Yeah,
13Ds, you know, people are distributing or grabbing up, right? I mean, there's all the letters. It doesn't matter all the letters. You can go down the list of the reasons why.
But you can find all those on the SEC filings. But, you know, it's really important to find out why they sold the stock in the first place. But you generally don't want to see a lot of insider transactions on the negative side if you're moving into a stock.
Right.
And then also, with regards to institutional holdings, you know, you want to have some institutions behind you, but you also don't want to have it where there's too many institutions. If they decide to get out, then you better be getting out with them. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble.
Trampled by the bulls.
Right.
Or bears, for that matter.
Exactly.
So the thing that I find interesting about that is when you look at the reasons and rationale, news reports and items that come out about insider sales, they usually try to soften the discussion because it's important for them not to spook anybody. So oftentimes you're going to find planned sales. Well, that's easy enough to look for. You just look at this variety of different places, Edgar Online, many of Yahoo will show you that and link through and show you the various planned sales that are out there. MSN Money does a good job of that. It will show you the planned sales. It will show you the pending sales, the recent sales, who did it, what the relationship is to the company. Are they maybe a major majority shareholder? Is it an insider? Is it an officer? Whatever it is. One of the things that I don't like, though, is when I see the announcement come out that they're doing it for diversification reasons. You know, they're doing it because they want to diversify their portfolios. I have never come across, I mean, even the guys that have all the, look at Bill Gates. His money's wrapped up in Microsoft. Yeah, he took some out and he spends, you know, I mean, he had to spend $1 million that day maybe on a, you know, on a car or a plane or something like that. But you know what? Most that you want to have a person with conviction with money in the company. Now, clearly there is a point for diversification. Clearly there's a point for estate planning purposes. No question about that you need to diversify and to take out some of the position. But more often than not, I find when there's no other reason to give besides they want to sell their stock, the answer is diversification.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
I think there's a difference in this situation here because, you know, several times, I think it's the Enron effect, we should say, mm-hmm. because you have several officers that, you know, maybe their pay is strictly based on options that they have, restricted stock that they've received, and the various other pieces. And, you know, a lot of the financial planners and investment advisors out there are saying, you know, diversification is key. Having your money wrapped up in company stock is it could be a potential problem because your pay is also based on that company. If that company goes under, you lose both your pay and your whole life savings.
Good. They should prevent it from going under. I'm a shareholder too.
Right. I agree with that.
Come on, hit me back on that one.
Well, I mean, there's a problem with that because, you know, not all the time does the you know, the COO or the CFO have the ability to change that.
Yeah, fire them all. No, I'm kidding. So no, seriously though, I do believe that their entire life doesn't have to be tied to the stock in the event that, you know, they get all of a sudden new technology comes out and they're just out. But at the same time, you can make the argument on the other side that they should have been up on that. You know, look at the Motorola situation when they came out with the Razor and then they came out with they didn't come out with anything after that, did they? Now that I think
they have Droid.
Oh, now they have Droid,
right.
Droid does what you don't do, or something of that nature. Okay, and now they came out with Droid, and wouldn't you know it, Google's coming out with their own phone on top of that.
That's
nice. Anyway, Cognizant. So Cognizant is this company which is they do customized consulting and they outsource. You could use them to outsource your technology. They build a cloud kind of for you. They're also involved in very many of the things that, for example, an EDS is or was, and an IBM, for example. They compete on those platforms, and basically they're international in scope and in scale. And this is a company that also has some great technicals. But we're gonna hold on to that for 1 second because we're gonna come back to the technicals. I want to talk to you about when we look at short interest and we look at, you know, shares trading. When we look generally at volume metrics, and again, this is some technical and some not, but and short interest, I mean, what are we looking for there? I mean, I think you can make an argument, can't you, that a high short interest is a really interesting play, as we saw, particularly in a bullish environment, because if the bulls start, you know, rattling the cage, all of a sudden the shorts may get spooked out and move the stock up very dramatically. On the other hand, you can make the case that there's a lot of short interest because the stock should be going a lot lower and a lot of smart people are betting against it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that twofold issue there is the fact that if the stock is moving up and the short interest is moving up, then you could have a case of the short sales or the short sellers having to stop out. But you know, if you have the stock moving down and the shorts are the short interest is moving up, then you have a real problem. The stock really probably will go down. But overall, you don't want to see too much short interest if you're looking to get into a company, unless, of course, you're willing to take that gamble that you're going to get the seller stopping out.
Right. So let's give an example about what happened in the recent week when it comes to maybe a short interest pop and all that. So earlier in the week, Take-Two came out with some information. Actually, before they came out with the information about their earnings and all that, there was an announcement that Carl Icahn came in, and he actually owns a 11% stake in the company now. So what's interesting is that stock immediately went up. Why? Well, you know, you don't want to fight City Hall. If Carl Icahn has a piece of it, couple things are going to happen. He may look to sell the company. He may look to reshake up and shake up management. He may look to do all sorts of different transactions, sell off pieces of the company. There's 100 different things that may actually happen there. But what's interesting is that when you look at that, why did the stock pop so much? Well, a lot of people are saying two things. One, if Carl Icahn's investing in it, I want to invest in it. They probably forgot about the days of Blockbuster and a few of these other deals.
But it's also interesting that Icahn came out and said that day, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right before before they delayed the earnings,
right?
And then the earnings came out and were crappy,
right?
They came out and they were selling a piece of the company, one of their gaming distribution companies, off.
That's correct, yeah.
For nothing major. Stock went down. We see an announcement about the same time about a hedge fund that owns about a 7% stake,
right?
And the stock is down 5% on the earnings news and on the projection news. Turns around that day, is up 1% by the end of the day, and then is up 4% the next day.
That's right.
That's a big turn.
That's a very big turn.
I mean, so the point though is here. Do you want to be fighting maybe a Carl Icahn that's been building a position and has a good amount of money to put into the stock to hold it up?
Yeah, and you know he can shake up the boards.
So. Oh, he could shake up the boards.
Yeah, it's like fighting major institutions. You never want to fight with the Goldmans, the Morgans.
Don't fight with Goldman. Goldman came out with a conviction buy on potash last week. We talked about being short potash. We were short potash. We made about, I think, 8.5% on the short in a number of days, 3 or 4 days. Goldman comes out with a conviction list after we see news story after news story, research after research about how potash prices are being cut down by a Belarusian company and a variety of other companies out there that are going to sell to, let's say, China and India and many of the emerging markets. They're cutting the prices down below $400 per metric ton, and it's getting ridiculous. So now they come out with a conviction list. It goes up 3.5%. We say we're not fighting it. We take our profits, made about, I think, close to 5% in 2 or 3 days, 4.5% in 2 or 3 days, and we're moving on. If it runs up again, we may end up shorting it again because the fundamentals haven't changed, other than the fact that there's an institution there that you don't want to fight. It's just not necessary.
And it'll come off their conviction buy list eventually, but you know, it's one of those things where you just don't want to get in front of those kind of earnings.
Right, exactly. So, all right, what's the next thing that we're going to save? We're going to save some as technicals. I told you there's a two-part show. I think I mentioned that to you, Kevin. We're going to talk next week, actually, about some of the technicals. We'll talk a little bit about today, but leave a little bit about that because I want to get into some of the technicals and actually give some other tips next week on what to be looking for and some of the things that we set up here. And we'll put some charts on the show notes for that. But just finishing off on this Cognizant issue, what about the market cap? What about the volume trading? You know, where do we put that in the big realm of things? And what can you tell people to be looking for here? Is there anything specific?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about in the beginning, it's important that the key point of these screens is to get it down to a manageable number of stocks in order to look deeper into these various nuances. So once we get these screens done, we want to look at some other things such as market cap, how big is the company, how much are you willing to invest in a very small company versus a very large and diverse corporation. You also have things such as beta, the alpha, the debt, 5 years.
There's a lot of things to be looking at, obviously.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of things to look at, and it's one of those things where these screens really help you get down to a manageable amount, a number of stocks.
Right. So back to our 30 when we talked about at the beginning at the top. Basically what you've done is you've taken the world of investing, which 5,000 stocks in the Wilshire just US based.
Right.
And we've narrowed it down to just 30 to be looking through.
Right.
I mean, it becomes an unmanageable mess to try to look through 500 stocks at once. Of course, you can just go to a manager and do that through a mutual fund, an ETF, or someone who you use out there. But if you want to start doing some of this yourself, some of these things you're going to have to know about. And I think that why don't we talk about maybe more specifics as an example about a company. We have a couple of different companies, but Apollo Group. And let's start. There's a couple of different Apollo groups, right? There's Apollo Investments and there's Apollo Education, let's call it.
Right.
Okay. So this group has seen a lot. The for-profit educational group,
right,
has seen a lot of volatility lately.
Yes, they have. They've had several regulatory problems.
Yeah. That's not good.
No,
don't fight the institutions.
Yeah. Anytime you get the regulatory problems, you're wanting to be exiting every position within that industry.
Yeah, within that moment.
Right.
So what happens is that I think there was a discussion about a couple different – this is not the first time this has happened, by the way. There's been a discussion and the regulatory groups coming down on a couple different things. It has to do with how they're actually doing their marketing for people to come in, some of the use of their questionable recruiting processes on some of these, some of the accounting issues. You know, once you hear accounting issues, that's a double whammy.
Right.
You know, you don't walk, run. You know, once you hear the accounting issue, if it's not a rumor, that's a problem.
Right.
So Apollo Group is part of this group. There's a few different companies, right?
There's Coco. You have
Corinthian. That's ITT, for example.
Seco, Career Education.
Career Education Company. And there's Apollo Group. There's a few others. I mean, you have some of the EDU, which is one that's out of
China,
which is kind of interesting, teaching a lot of the English. There's K-12, Capella Education. A lot of companies out there that are in this genre, let's call it. And they've been doing very well because if you think about it for a second, if there is a lot of jobs that people need to get eventually and a lot of skills they need to establish, well, these companies may be going to benefit from that. One of the things that is a concern is, of course, they loan the money oftentimes to the people to come in and to take the courses. And what happens if people don't finish and they don't want to pay, especially in these kind of times? So that's one of the issues that's overriding this, and the debt ratio issues that we look at.
It's quite a few government grants as well that are coming in. And when these people leave the government grants or they decide that they don't want to finish up the education, then it's then their liability to pay for it. You know, if the government gives you money to finish an education, then you should finish it. But otherwise, you're going to be paying for it.
Should, yeah. And then again, many people, the concern has been that, you know, who's going to be left with holding the bag here if they're not paying for it?
Exactly.
But let's talk about Apollo in particular. You know, we've looked at these companies, but there's a bit of a double-edged sword that you and I talked about
right.
Apollo, right? So the fundamentals are one thing, but there's something that's a bit of a cautionary note, which we may have talked about. But let's go through some of that. Let's talk about some of the fundamentals and what we should be looking at, and what people can be writing down, you know, kind of penciling in about Apollo. As an example, this is just for education. This is not a recommendation to buy. We don't own Apollo at this time.
Right.
We may move into it anytime, you know, in or out of it. Right now, I think Apollo is about 35 or so percent off of its 52-week high. It's done very well historically, but then came down, crashing down. But let's go through what this is. They have what? They have about 350 facilities. What's the story with them?
Yeah, it's about 385 facilities, and they have approximately 443,000 students in those facilities. But, you know, going back, the problem with this company is they have great fundamentals. It's one of those things where you could look at it at a glance and say, wow, this is a fantastic company. I've got to get in and I got to buy. Problem with that is that you don't see any of the regulatory problems. You don't see the accounting issues. You don't see any of that kind of stuff. And some of the things that you can see without having to delve into all those regulatory issues is the technical side. You can see the stock coming down. You can see the huge gaps from one day to the next. And that's a major red flag. If you see those things, then you know you should be looking deeper into what is wrong. Because if the fundamentals look great, you can't just rely on the fundamentals, unfortunately, because everything can change in a matter of moments.
Right. So here's how we think of it, and what I've preached many times, wrote in my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, available at Amazon. You know, but why are we stressing this? Because the quantitative side, the screening gets you narrowed down. You can use fundamentals and technicals inside the screens to narrow down what we're looking for. We want good growth. We want a PEG ratio under one. We want to have a market cap over $1 billion. We want to have at least 500,000 shares trading on a daily basis. We want to see no insider selling for the last 6 months. We want to see earnings growth rate at least 22% a year. We want to see the return on equity at least 15%, blah, 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 blah. Okay.
Right.
Now, that's great. We got all these stocks. What do you do with them? Well, there's people like Jim O'Shaughnessy have come up with these screens that they just invest in that, you know, just like the dogs of the Dow. Dogs of the Dow in this process says you find those 10 stocks, You invested them in the beginning of the year. At the end of the year, you sell the ones that don't meet the criteria for the next year and keep on doing that. It's a pretty much just a very easy strategy to replicate. Jim O'Shaughnessy, in his book, What Works on Wall Street, a great book, a very easy read, very thick, but easy read because it's just the data and the backup and all that. He shows, like, you know, the greatest is a small cap with price to sales under this. That's what you invest in over time. Or you look at a P/E ratio combination with price to sale, price to book for financials. Okay, that's great. But the problem, again, is, as Kevin said, that tells you what's happening with the company. A lot of investment managers out there are all about either growth or value, or they look at things like the cash flow. They look at the balance sheets. They look at wanting to see GARP, growth at a reasonable price. We think that you can't just be so one-sided. There are three important parts, three dimensions, if you will, to the disciplined investment process, which is simply the quantitative, looking at the screens, finding then from there what is going on, what's happening underneath the hood, if you will, looking at that. And then what you could see from the technical side is, what is the rest of the world thinking of this? What is the investors seeing? So we see gaps, for example. We see the various indicators starting to move in a certain direction, whether it's stochastics, whether it's a MACD, whether it's an RSI. We need to look at what's happening to get the take, because a lot of information oftentimes isn't known by everyone. And what happens is, even last week we saw the takeout of Chatham. The buyout of Chatham is now being challenged. There was about a $4.5 million windfall that a few of the people got because they were insiders buying up the options. We've seen that time and time again. And, you know, there's news that may be leaking out, number one. Number two, there may be some information that is kind of starting to brew up, whether it's a court case, whether it's a takeover, whether it's a competitor, whether it's a bad product recall, whatever it may be. And you can oftentimes see that in the technicals. So, you know, that's an important part, because if you don't look at the technicals, you're not knowing exactly maybe when the right time to invest, because you may have the greatest company in the world, but if the timing is not right, it's not a good time to invest. Well, then, I mean, the fact of the matter is that maybe it's not something you want to look at right now. Hold it on the side, create your price points, and then pick it up from there. Kevin, what we're going to do is we'll pick this up next week. We'll talk about the technicals, kind of leave you on a cliffhanger here. We'll bring a couple of stocks. I want you to bring a couple of stocks next week. We'll bring back some of the fundamentals just briefly, but talk about how the technicals maybe either proved or disproved and where the stock could be going, and give a little bit of a lesson. And maybe what we could do is also put some charts up on next week's show notes and go from there. Does that sound good?
That sounds great.
Okay. So we're going to end it right there for the Disciplined Investor Podcast, the episode number 141. And this is your Merry Christmas and your Happy Hanukkah and your Kwanzaa and all that good stuff. Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, China, whatever that's called. Happy New Year podcast. I thank you so much for being with me today. And I wish you a very well, warm, and a lovely new year. If you're listening to that time, 2010 is right around the corner. You're going to have a great year. I know it. And with our help and with your listening, we're going to have a good year as well. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you real soon on the next Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.